What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning.
Show me the money!
My name is Jared. I'm joined here with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Austin.
Yo.
And Tommy.
Hey, Jared.
All right, so today we're breaking down The Lighthouse, the 2019 film directed by Robert Eggers, starring Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. As always, we're going to go around and get first impressions. What was it like watching this movie for the first time? What was it like revisiting it for this podcast? Let's start with the man across from me. Let's start with Tommy.
Well, I think the first time I saw this was like 3 months ago, so so I wasn't there wasn't a ton of distance in my mind. I kind of had the same feeling after watching it a second time. I think it's the ultimate Reddit movie, for good or for ill.
Okay.
It's a movie that is sort of designed to pose questions. But I find its sort of ambiguity. The ambiguity isn't of itself the point, which I find mildly irritating. I find it to be very emotionally distant. I have a hard time getting into this movie, and I really love The Witch, but this one keeps me sort of curiously distant. Having said that, great Pattinson. The cinematography is excellent. Dafoe is great. It's a good movie. I just don't love it like a lot of other people do.
It's funny you say it's the ultimate Reddit movie, and that because I was, when I chose this movie, I was like, hell yeah, we're going to have so much to talk about. And then when I watched it a second time, I was like, oh, well, it definitely looks cool. But that's not to say that I don't think there's some things to talk about, but I think that you are right. I think that there's a lot of deliberately planned ambiguity that's there to kind of create this sense of foreboding and mystery that works really well, but you can't really say much about it. Yeah. Backing it up with too much evidence.
Yeah, I don't know what the movie's... I mean, I guess we're going to talk about it, but I'm not 100% sure what the movie's really trying to say. And if it is, I think it's trying to say a lot of different things.
I think it's just trying to creep you out.
Yeah, that's fair too.
Austin, what'd you think?
Honestly, it's similar. I saw it like 3 weeks ago, and then I saw it yesterday. So, because it just came out a little bit later here, so it was super fresh. But I walked out of it, and I said I want to watch this again, because I feel like I'm missing stuff, you know? Like, I felt like... the praise that it's getting should have made it more profound than the experience that I had. Like, I kind of walked out and I was like, okay, like, it's almost super profound, black and white, psychosexual, heart of darkness, madness. And I was like, oh, it's interesting. And then I kind of, maybe it was, it just left me a little like, okay, like, yeah, it was a thing. I don't know. Like,
see,
I was expecting like Von Trier, like effect on me, you know, and it didn't have that effect.
No, it's not quite that. That was the movie we were going to do. We were going to do Melancholia today, but we had to reschedule. You know, I agree with everything that you guys are saying, but for the same reasons, I love the movie.
Really?
Just because. It was stylistically cool. I also just love both of those actors. I love Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. I think these are some of the most beastly work he's ever done.
Some
of those monologues are just amazing.
They are both great in the movie.
The language is ridiculous. It is amazing how they handled the language. I mean, same thing though with The Witch, right? The Witch, the language again. I mean, he's a tremendous writer.
I haven't seen The Witch. But I was appalled by how amazing and precise the dialogue was to really capture, I suppose, the movie takes place like off the coast of Maine in the 1800s or something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know much about that time period, but I bought into it for sure.
Yeah, the dialogue creates this mood, so.
Yeah, absolutely. So I like the movie in terms of what it's trying to say. I don't know, maybe we'll come upon something, but I was interested the whole time. As far as it being emotionally distant, I would agree with that. When we learn more about the young guy's past and how he killed a guy to maintain his identity, I don't really know if we were supposed to feel anything about that. Yeah, I'm a little bit at a loss.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against emotionally distant movies in general. I mean, I love Kubrick. I love David Fincher. So, I mean, there's nothing against emotionally distant movies, but it's hard when you're sort of tracking a man's descent into madness. That's such an emotional thing, I think. Mm. And we're always sort of arm's length from Pattinson as he sort of descends into madness. So we're never really, we're experiencing his madness, but we're always arm's length from it at the same time. So it's hard to sort of become emotionally involved as much as I think you should in a movie about a guy going slowly insane.
Yeah.
You should feel like you're going insane.
Yeah,
I think.
It should have an effect on the audience that it's taken. Yeah, I agree. And I didn't feel that. I felt like I was just watching something. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
Okay.
I have a question. Oh, wait. All right, we got to do the recap, but I have a question too. At what point
does a
stylistic choice just become like doing it for the sake of it being cool? Like the black and white and the frame, I was like, it's cool. But like, at what point is it just like, and I don't want to sound like a dickhead, but is it just, cause we all have come out of this background, but at what point is it just like, film school?
Oh, see, I think that it's just done so well.
It is so beautiful. So
I mean, I think you almost can't do this movie without doing the way it was stylistically done. I mean, I don't think the movie would be effective. I don't think it would really haunt people like I think it has. And I don't think that there's any deeper reason for it being black and white and the, what was the aspect ratio, like 1:19:1 or something like that. And yeah, I think it's just really these people, the movie just strikes me as a vision, a really evocative, really, not necessarily a profound vision, but one that really sticks with you. Yeah.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cases solved using forensic genealogy. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about this remarkable new crime-solving tool, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing it. I include input from law enforcement to give you the inside scoop that we all crave with a straightforward, no-nonsense delivery. You can find DNA ID on any podcast platform. Episodes come out weekly on Mondays.
All right, guys, let's go into a recap. So, two workers, one old and one young, arrive on an island to work a lighthouse for 4 weeks. As Young settles in, he finds an ivory carving of a mermaid hidden in his bed. Young performs his manual duties during the day shift, and while traditionally they should trade off, Old insists on keeping the night shift, or tending to the light, all to himself. Meanwhile, Young sees haunting images of a dead man and a mermaid in the water. The next day, a one-eyed seagull blocks Young's work path, causing him to throw some coal at it. Later, Old informs Young that his previous second went mad and died raving about mermaids and the light being enchanted. Then Old forcefully insists that it's bad luck to pick fights with a seabird, as the souls of dead sailors reside in them. Soon after, Young reveals that his name is Winslow. One night, Young is drawn to the lighthouse, where Old seems to be in the throes of ecstasy with a tentacled monster. Next day, the one-eyed gull taunts Young as he tries to work. Young snaps and kills the gull. The night before Young is leaving the island, him and Old get drunk, and Old reveals that his real name is Thomas. Young again envisions a sexy mermaid swept upon the shore, but Young's plans to leave the island are ruined when a storm comes in. Next day, Old suggests that it's been weeks since they were supposed to leave. Old and Young drink more and more as they descend into madness. Young finds a one-eyed head in the water and eventually spills his beans to Old. His real name is also Thomas, and he killed a man named Winslow to assume his identity. When the storm turns their lodgings upside down, Young finds Old's logbook and discovers that Old has recommended Young be fired without pay. Young's anger reaches a boiling point, beats Old, and tries to bury him alive while Old speaks of Young's inevitable punishment. Young takes Old's keys and is about to unlock the lighthouse when Old attacks Young, forcing Young to kill Old. When Young opens the light and stares into it, he screams with an insane intensity and falls all the way down the stairs. Young awakens with his innards splayed open, seabirds feasting on his liver. End of movie.
Don't fuck with a seabird, man.
Don't fuck with a seabird. But before we go any farther, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors over at Skillshare. So one of the values that we hold really dear at Wisecrack is being a lifelong learner, and Skillshare shares that mission statement, so we're really happy to have them sponsoring us. If you're looking to explore new skills or get inspired or deepen your existing passions, Skillshare is an online learning community where you can explore and discover thousands of classes on a wide variety of topics like graphic design, productivity, creative writing, film and video, freelancing, and more. And if you're looking for a class to take, I recommend checking out iPhone Filmmaking, creating cinematic video on your phone. I don't know if some of you caught the movie Tangerine back in 2015, but it was a great movie shot entirely on an iPhone. So after that movie, there's really no excuse for you not to be the next Scorsese. So teachers Caleb and Niles will teach you all the nuances to make your iPhone videos good enough for the silver screen. They detail the equipment, apps, and workflow that is helpful for both beginners and experienced cinematographers curious about shooting on an iPhone. And when you compare it to expensive in-person workshops or night classes, Skillshare is really affordable. An annual subscription is less than $10 a month. And right now they're offering Show Me the Meaning listeners 2 free months. All you got to do is go to Skillshare.com/wisecrack. Again, that's Skillshare.com/wisecrack for 2 free months of unlimited access to awesome classes. And now back to the show.
Tell me you like my cooking.
I was going to say, why'd you spill your beans? All right, so let's start with the thing that I think is really kind of the only obvious big kind of aha meaning thing here, and that's the Promethean myth. So at the end, the gulls are eating his liver, just like the birds ate Prometheus's immortal liver. So to summarize, the Titan Prometheus stole fire from the gods and gave it to man. In return, Zeus chained him to a rock and sent an eagle to eat his liver. Prometheus was only released when he tells Zeus that the sea nymph Thetis, whom both Zeus and Poseidon were pursuing, would give birth to Achilles, whose mortal father would ensure that he was not immortal. So here's my first question. We know what Prometheus was punished for. There's even a part in Willem Dafoe's monologue while he's being buried where he says, "Oh, what protean forms swim up from men's minds and melt in hot Promethean plunder, scorching eyes with divine shames and horrors, and cast them down to Davy Jones." I wish I could. I would read the whole thing if I had. If we had the
pretty
time.
Good, but, man.
You're doing good. You're doing good there. Keep
you,
going.
Thank you. No, I want. Oh. I actually don't have the rest written down. what do you guys think he's being punished for exactly?
Well, I mean, it's the search for knowledge, right? Like he wants. What is he being punished for? I mean, he wants the knowledge that he feels has been deprived from him, right? So it's. Like Prometheus was trying to give mass knowledge to the masses, he just wants knowledge for himself and is punished for that sin. Do you think
that makes sense to me?
So there's a philosopher named Bernard Stiegler who has written a series of books called Technics in Time, and he talks about the Promethean myth and then the Epimethean myth who is like his brother, I think. But the idea is that what you get with Prometheus is that he's stealing technology. It's not just knowledge. He's actually stealing technology. So the myth could be a way of helping us to understand how technology kind of constitutes us as human beings. Like we are beings insofar as we use technology, right? And so maybe the idea here is the light of the lighthouse is a powerful and important technology to save ships and things like that. But when, you know, kind of when you open the door of needing technology, you end up in a world potentially like we are now where everything is platformed. You know, we talk about some of the pitfalls of technology and things like that. So, you know, maybe that's what you have. And so it could be that this is a myth. If it's a Promethean myth, it could be a type of a punishment just for simply being human because of stealing technology. And he is a man who is like, he guards the lighthouse. He guards this singular technology. And that's why Pattinson, when he looks into that light, he almost has like an orgasm. Because there is some weird psychosexual
shit going on.
That's
what I was just
going
to bring up.
Right?
Yeah,
so
I was going to bring up it's kind of
sexual and erotic about the light and technology that like will save you or that will make you feel whole. But it doesn't. He stares into the fucking light and then he falls down because you can't touch the real, you know?
It's like Videodrome-esque.
You know what? I didn't even think about that, but yeah.
In a weird way. I hadn't really thought about it in terms of technology, but I definitely was thinking about, okay, there seems to be some mix of sexual pleasure and insanity and horror, and to Tommy's point, what he said earlier, I think there's really not anything in particular in terms of any singular vision that the Eggers were really thinking that it was that he was looking at.
I could also argue that it's self-knowledge. I mean, this is a character, both these characters are sort of living in denial and they're refusing to sort of cop to their own sort of misdeeds and who they really are. And so, I mean, by looking into the light, he's being confronted by the truth of who and what he is. And this sort of, and seeing who he is causes him to sort of lose his mind fall over and die. There's a whole theory, and I sort of ascribe to this that young and old are potentially one in the same, theoretically. Mm. And so him coming to the knowledge that potentially he is Willem Dafoe, and he will end up in this same sort of situation is what sort of drives him to this, to his own insanity.
Yeah, there's that fate, that fatedness that, that you would get in tragedy and myth, right? There's always there's some sort of fate of the gods or fate being determined by the gods or something like that. So maybe, yeah, that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah, because there was the whole thing with not only Young being tortured by the fact that he killed the Ephraim Winslow guy, the blonde guy that he keeps on seeing, but also that Old gets caught in all these lies of how did he lose, how did he get his leg all messed up, or and yeah,
they're weird mirror images of each other, because Young is obsessed with, I'm going to work on this island, I'm going to get my money, and then I'm going to go have a family, and I won't have to listen to any other guy tell me what to do. Meanwhile, Old is like, I had a family, I went over to see, get rid of them, to get away from them, and then I ended up here, and this is the only place where I really belong. So there's a weird sort of duality between them.
That's interesting.
That no matter what, you sort of end up, you can try to do this to get a family, or you can try to do this to get away from a family, but inevitably you just end up alone on a lighthouse.
Going crazy.
With weird psych, you're going crazy.
What do you guys think about the emphasis on teasing us with mythology? So there's like when Young says he doesn't like Old's cooking, Old calls out to Triton to smite him. Triton was a Greek god of the sea, the son of Poseidon. When Young beats Old, he sees Old as a tentacled monster. Do you think we're supposed to believe that Old is some kind of mythological creature, whether it be Triton or Poseidon? There's also that shot where Young sees his doppelganger, and then he turns around and Old is behind him naked, and that shot of him is just so cool, but it looks like Old is almost godly in that shot, and then he opens his mouth and it sprays light at him. Yeah, what do you guys, how deep does the mythology stuff go? Because I'm tempted to say, like, I mentioned the nymph Thetis before, and part of me is like, well, is the mermaid the nymph Thetis, or is it just a mermaid?
Well, didn't Egger say that he's Proteus, right? Or is that, did Defoe? I think he said that Defoe is supposed to represent Proteus, and Pattinson is Prometheus. And what would happen if those two ever crossed paths? The keeper of the knowledge and the one who seeks to get the knowledge for himself and others.
Oh, so. Well, shit. He just showed us the meeting. Thanks, Robert Eggers. Shit.
All right. Show's done. Later.
Show's done. That's it. Show's done. So when Young finds the head of the previous worker, it only has one eye in it, just like the seagull that was pestering him. I don't know. If the seagull is the spirit of dead sailors, then what was the spirit of the previous assistant trying to tell him or stop him from doing? Or was he just there to torture him?
Well, I mean, how much do you buy what we actually see in the movie? How reliable do you feel like Robert Pattinson actually is as a narrator in this?
That was my question, because I didn't think that it was a reliable.
Well, even
I think the entire movie is unreliable.
Yeah. Well, even Old says that you could be back in the trees and this could all be a figment of your imagination. I could be a figment of your imagination. It's rare that a movie comes out and just says that.
which I
kind of appreciate, because it almost.
Well, the weirdest moment is when we watch Defoe try to kill him with the axe and break the boat, and they go back into the house, and Defoe is like, why did you chase me with axe and destroy my boat? And are you supposed to interpret that as, is he gaslighting?
He's gaslighting, yeah.
Or is that actually what actually did happen, and what we're seeing is totally wrong?
Well, and then there's the whole thing with him saying that 3 weeks have gone by, Pattinson only thinks a day has gone by.
Yeah, I wondered that too, when especially at that moment. I thought it was going to... I'm glad they didn't make it too heavy-handed, though. I thought it was going to be heavy-handed, like, oh, this whole thing you've been watching the whole time was just I'm glad they didn't do that. Like, we've seen that a million times. I get it. I see dead people. Whatever. I'm glad they didn't quite have that kind of reveal or twist, because it did... You know how Tommy and I were talking? It didn't quite give us the anxiety that we would have liked it to give us. I think they tried. It tried, and maybe in some people it was more effective, but it was that moment in particular where I was kind of like, okay, I get it. We're supposed to be confused. We're not really supposed to understand what's going on. We're supposed to be ourselves experiencing a descent into madness.
Yeah. Why do you think they chose mermaids? God, it seems like such a random thing,
is it,
right?
But no, but isn't it like sailors? To stay consistent, right? To the whole the mer people. Do they have mermen? Mermaids were like these feared entities, mythological entities, and then sometimes they would save you. You know, was it dolphins that people saw, and then they were just hallucinating? You know, we don't really know, but they're such a part of the sailor lore that the world that he was creating. Like, the mermaid is extremely important for the sailors and for being out there on the Cape or wherever they were, you know.
I also saw the mermaid as sort of emblematic of sort of Pattinson's dream. He wants to get away and find a wife. And so the mermaid is sort of the grotesque version of this woman who will drag him away, but will, you know, kill him and drown him in the sea. So sort of of the perversity of his fantasy.
Mm. Yeah, because sexuality in this film is not pretty. It's not beautiful. It is perverse. And whether it's the two of them that have that moment where you think they're going to kiss and then bang, or there's a bit where I think, is it Pattinson or Defoe? I can't remember which one, but sees the other guy's butt when he's in bed, you know?
Old is like having a wet dream or something, and he's like slightly humping the bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, so this is what I wonder. I wonder then, I'm going to go super abstract here. I wonder if the film could really be about like the perversion of desire, and that's why you can't look into the light, right? But like light and sexuality and all of those things are perverse in this film, and it's because we have that perversion that we are guilty or we are corrupted. So both of them are then fated. Like if young is going to be fated to become old, it's because of human corruption, because of desire. And then maybe that has something to do with the idea of we have a fall, like with a capital F, like the fall, in a very similar Promethean sense, right? Or in an Adam and Eve kind of sense, that there's a fall, there's a corruption of our nature. And so all of this shit now happens to us because we are just simply fated towards destruction or whatever, that seagulls will eat out our innards. Welcome to life.
I really like your reading on technology, but maybe that's just because, you know, I'm a huge Videodrome fan, and it also is just akin to a lot of the technophobia that we kind of tend to dive into sometimes.
Well, so you didn't see The Witch, right? But
no, I didn't.
There's a lot of similar, like, tones and themes, guilt and religion. Like, I feel like this guy studied religion or grew up in the church in like a Puritan, like reformed church, because that's really what The Witch kind of, that's the background of the community. What is it, 1600s, like Puritan, maybe early 1700s, like Puritan village on the east coast of the United States. So there's something about religion, guilt, a fall, sexuality, those things that are repeated themes, I think, in both of the films.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
I'll have to check it out.
It's great.
I didn't do my homework. I should have seen the. So you also like that movie better than this one?
I think so, yeah. The first time I saw The Witch, I didn't get it, actually. Like, again, it just didn't land. And then I saw it the second time, and I was like, oh, okay. So maybe that'll happen with this film, actually. Because I saw it the second time, and I was like, okay, I think I was expecting a horror movie. You know, like a scary movie when I saw The Witch. Mm-hmm. And then I think even with this one, I was expecting, I don't know why I was expecting that. I'm a freaking idiot. Learn something, Austin. You made this mistake with his last film. You should know better. But I think I went in maybe with different expectations for this film as well. I thought they were going to be creepier or scarier, and I didn't get that distinct vibe. It's more provocative and intriguing than scary, I think. Both of them.
I would agree. And I would say that the style and the performances just intrigued me enough for the full 2 hours. And into it.
Yeah,
I mean, my next question was just going to be about the aspect ratio in the film stock. It was filmed on black and white, 35mm negative, and an aspect ratio of 1:19:1, which basically looks like a 4:3 television type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was 4:3, so, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, 4:3 is only for televisions,
typically,
right?
Typically, it's only for TV.
Yeah. Is it? Okay. Yeah.
But I think if you're actually shooting, like, what, like, Anamorphic is like 235. Yeah. So anyway,
I mean, it's beautiful.
Any particular?
It is. It's beautiful. There's no denying that it's beautiful. I enjoy when aspect ratios are different, and it felt like I was watching a newsreel, almost like an old timey black and white newsreel. Like it had that kind of like I wish I could hear the flicking of the projector. Like I wish I had that kind of experience. So it's beautiful, and I think that it does add to the creepiness, even if I don't think it's as creepy as I maybe was expecting it to be or something like that. It creates a sort of dark tone that just falls over the theater. At least it did for me. Like, I felt like everyone
when you hear
in
that
there.
Foghorn.
Yeah.
When you hear that foghorn over that black and white, I mean, it is pretty haunting, I think.
It is.
Yeah, it feels like it's like hearkening back to some like Hammer movies with like these fog coming in and characters sort of stuck and isolated in one place. Yeah. And what happens from there. So this seems sort of a modern retelling of this sort of old-fashioned genre that is.
What did you say? Hammer movies?
Yeah, like Hammer, like horror movies back in like the 50s. And like they were a production company that made like, you know, Dracula and all these other sort of lower budget.
Gotcha.
Type of horror movies.
Interesting.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Yeah.
Like the terror, stuff like that.
Huh. Yeah, that is interesting. I actually read the script for this movie before this podcast, which is something I've never done before because
I glanced at it too. Yeah.
Because of the language, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything.
The script is great.
The script is amazing. Yeah.
Is it?
And there was a couple parts that, you know, you watch a movie. And when you don't, obviously when you watch a movie, you don't get to see the scene descriptions that are in the script. And I was surprised at how many times what I was interpreting was happening on screen was very different than what the script was describing. Mm. So, for example, when he's putting the, what is it, caulk or chalk inside of their water thing, and then like he's sloshing it around, and then like the camera shows us the chalk inside of the water. And in the script, it was like it was almost beautiful. And I was like, wow, I did not really get a sense of awe or beauty from that scene. Mm-hmm. And so
there's even like a musical sting at the end of that scene, as I recall, like our foreboding like musical cue goes over the shifting water.
There's a couple of musical cues that Willem Dafoe's character is supposed to sing in the movie that they cut out.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. which is a little bit of a shame because... Mm. Because I would have, I'd pay to just see hear anything else come out of Willem Dafoe's mouth in that movie.
So performance-wise, it is extremely important, I think, to praise these kinds of films. Like, these kinds of films need to get made, you know? And it's, we often talk about, like, the death of cinema. Scorsese comes out and is like, you know, Marvel films are not cinema. And he's probably right. But what does that mean? What is cinema? And there's something about this kind of film that, not just to be like a snob, like a film snob that likes bravura performances or something like that, but it's important that these kinds of films get made and that they're successful and they keep getting made and that people like Eggers and others can keep getting funding because it's brilliant. It really is. Like, the performances I thought were so, it was theatrical and in the good way, not over the top or melodramatic, but just, I felt like I was watching something that we'll be talking about performance-wise at least for decades, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird to see that Robert Pattinson has become such a great and such a strange actor. Yeah. Such a weird... Yeah. Like, he made this movie and High Life, the Claire Denis movie, which is also super weird and super good.
So that one I didn't see, but I did see Good Time. I did
that
see
is,
Good
Time. And Good Time. Yeah, Good Time.
Good Time's amazing.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because we were debating 5 years ago about if you were on Team Edward or Team whatever the fuck the other guy's name was.
It's Team Edward.
Edward has won. Edward has won. Yeah. Whatever even happened to Taylor Lautner? Is he still doing movies?
Yeah, I remember. No, he's not. I think he was given like one shot. He had like this blockbuster action movie.
Where he's like,
yeah,
I did.
Where he's, and it tanked and then his career's over. Well, guys, I got really nothing else.
Well, let me ask you this.
That was the thing about this movie. Yeah, please do.
If we're talking about Pattinson, it's a little bit of a rabbit trail. but it still relates to the film because we know how amazing he is as an actor now, right? He's not just the guy from Twilight anymore. Do we have hope that he will be good as Batman?
I do. Sure.
Yeah, I have all the faith in Pattinson. I was not a big fan of his off of Twilight. I actually thought K-Stu was excellent. I was always on board with K-Stu, but I thought Pattinson didn't have much. And I saw him in Cosmopolis. I didn't get why people loved him in Cosmopolis.
Well, Cosmopolis has a lot of problems.
Cosmopolis does have a lot of problems, but Good Time, really.
It's one of my favorite directors, and I almost walked out of that movie.
I think his performance in Good Time is one of the best modern day acting performances.
Oh, wow.
And I think he, and I love Defoe, I think he out-acts Defoe. I don't even know how that's possible in this movie.
Yeah, I don't know how that's possible.
So he's great. So yes, he's going to be good.
And I remember one thing that I think it was Matt Damon said when the internet was freaking out about Batfleck. He said, look, it's not fucking Hamlet. He's playing Batman. I think Robert Pattinson is going to do all.
I just hope he continues making these weirder movies. That he doesn't get sucked down the rabbit hole of Batman, Batman 2, Batman 3.
I think he will.
Matt Reeves.
I think he will keep making these. I don't know why. I have no evidence that I'm basing this off of. It's just a gut sense.
Well, because, if he did it at all, it obviously wasn't for the money. So obviously he's got some idealism in him. My biggest concern about Batman is everyone else. Like, is everyone else going to bring their A game to the table? Who's writing it?
I love Matt Reeves. Matt Reeves is great, and he wrote it.
Okay. Anyway. All right, guys. Anything else you guys want to bring up about the movie?
I'll say this time watching it, I felt the movie was the art house office space. I thought it was a movie. It's a movie all about a guy working a dead end job who just wants his boss to promote him and show him the goddamn lighthouse. And he tells him, maybe one day you'll get that promotion. Just work a little harder for 2 more weeks. We'll get you your pay. And 2 weeks turns into 3 months, turns into 2 years. And 2 years later, you find yourself working the same dead end job with no sight of a promotion. And the only way to get that promotion is to kill your boss and get the lighthouse for yourself. And I don't know if I'm projecting, but that is what I got from watching it the second time.
That's a great take.
Talk about him a lot on this podcast, or I do anyway, but the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, he famously has this painting. I think it's called like The Birth of the World, something along those lines, like the origin of the world or the birth of the world. And it's basically just a close-up of a woman's vagina. And Zizek talks about how this is the real. Like, we fantasize about the sexual object. We want it. But when it's, like, up front staring at you in the face, you don't want it anymore. And I think that's kind of, like, it's too monstrous. It's too much. It's too real. That's why it's the real. So I think that's kind of what is happening in this film, too. It's exactly what Tommy was just talking about. Like, you need this thing. You have this thing that is impelling you forward, and you can't ever attain it. And even if you did attain it, you probably would die. And that's what happens when Pattinson looks into the lighthouse. Like, he can't actually attain mastery over the technology. He can't actually attain knowledge or self-awareness. He has to suppress it somehow. Because if you stare into the light, you'll fall back down and you'll get eaten by seagulls or something like that.
Very cool. You guys really brought it this episode because I was like, big old question mark, and you guys have shown me the meaning. All right, you guys cool? You just cut it a little short, go to the mailbag?
Yeah.
Yeah, go to the mailbag.
How many of you have seen Sonic the Hedgehog?
Oh, I've seen it.
Oh, you have. Austin, I know you've seen it, right?
I endured it.
Oh, God, he really did see it. I was expecting him to say no. All right, great. All right, so this is from R, just letter R. What's up, Showing Me the Crew? My name is... Oh, it's not just R. His name is Rasheem, and he wanted to talk about Sonic the Hedgehog. While I thought the Sonic movie was really good, the Olive Garden was gratuitous, but my significant other made a great point. It makes sense to use the Olive Garden because when you go to the Olive Garden, you're... Tell me, Tommy.
Family?
Exactly. Just a thought that I wanted to share. Love all the content. Very excited Jared is back. Thank you, Rasheem. This one is from Craig. Haven't seen the Sonic movie, but listen to your review. Sounds like the Mushroom World is the first level in Sonic and Knuckles' Mushroom Hill Zone. Also, I've got a comment about an ancient episode you did when I sent to the wrong email ages ago. All right, well, first, as far as the Mushroom Hill Zone thing, thank you for that, because I thought it was some sort of a Mario illusion, and I was very wrong. I haven't played Sonic and Knuckles since...
I was.
I didn't understand anything you just said.
Yeah, no, yeah, the last one, I played the one game on Sega Genesis when I was like, what, 10 or something like that? I have not stayed up with the franchise. This was not a film that was made for Austin. Like, this was a film. Yeah. Like, I wasn't even a Sega Genesis guy. I was, like, a PlayStation guy. Like, wasn't there a competition at the time where it was like,
no,
are you
man,
PlayStation?
No, man, that was totally Super Nintendo. No,
Super
was
Nintendo.
Totally Super Nintendo. Super Nintendo. It was.
I was a Super Nintendo
Genesis
guy.
Genesis do what Nintendo don't.
Look, Sonic has like 2 minutes. The movie has like 2 minutes that are actually good when Jim Carrey does his evil dance.
Dance? Yeah.
That's it. That's all.
Hey, man.
I got my
Jim
money's
Carrey,
worth
Jim
just
Carrey's
from that.
Good in that movie. All right. So this is about Batman v Superman. Batman v Superman, the scene where Batman stops himself from killing Superman when he says Martha is supposed to be a callback to the opening scene of the movie where Bruce's dad says Martha while dying in the sidewalk. I got that from a Reddit comment from Craig. Cool. All right. This one is from Ariel, or Ariel. Very appropriate for a movie with mermaids in it. But she wanted to talk about her Olive Garden experience, because I think Michael had a call for Olive Garden experiences during our Sonic podcast. She says, when I just graduated from college, I moved to a small town in New York State to help my grandfather who suffered from a stroke. His favorite restaurant was Olive Garden. He would have us eat there 2 to 3 times a week. To make it worse, I'm a bit of a picky eater, and he always wanted to order off the 2 for $20 menu. At the time, there were only 2 entrees I liked on the menu. As you can imagine, I hated the Olive Garden with a passion by weeks 12 to 16. I specifically recall asking him if we could stay in and that I would cook or we could go to another restaurant one night, but he only wanted Olive Garden. When we got there, I began to glare at my wine glass and kept thinking, I pray this place burns to the ground. I repeated that mantra in my head the entire time we were there. The next morning, I'm preparing our breakfast and he's watching the news in the living room. He suddenly announces how we won't be going to Olive Garden anymore. As I calmed down after last night, I said, oh no, why is that? You love that place. He responds, it burnt to the ground last night. I dropped what I was doing to watch the news. It had literally burnt to the concrete foundation without leaving a structure. Thankfully, no one was hurt. The cause of the fire was due to an employee who had left a pot of water on the stovetop and forgot to turn it off. Anyway, love the podcast. Would love for you to do Birds of Prey next, which I have not seen.
Why do people talk so much shit about Olive Garden? Honestly, it's not bad.
It is. It's like it's the Guy Fieri of restaurants, right?
No, it's terrible. You guys are crazy. You guys are fucking
okay, well,
nuts.
Tommy's a major foodie.
Yeah. Oh my God. I can't even set foot in an Olive Garden.
Those breadsticks are good, man. You're telling me
on,
that.
Whatever.
See, fine. The breadsticks are fine. If anyone's going to, this man is a food snob. But hey, no, I love you for it. I could probably eat happily at the Olive Garden. I'm a man of exceptionally low
taste
when it comes to food.
There are so many good Italian restaurants in Los Angeles.
I'm sure
there's so many good ones.
But how many of them have unlimited?
Oh my God!
Unlimited X,
unlimited
Y, Z.
Is not a benefit. Unlimited sushi is not no bueno either.
No,
it's
better.
No, no, no.
All you can eat is better. It just is.
You're just not a disgusting man, Tommy. All right.
Anything you can eat all of is not something you want to eat.
All right. This one is from Martin. He says, I just wanted to offer my 2 cents on why Sonic referred to Tom as Donut Lord and Dr. Robotnik as Eggman. I'll just add from what you guys said, perhaps the writers needed a dot to connect and justify Sonic dubbing Dr. Robotnik Eggman. Implement the easy trope of cops loving donuts. I love that they don't simply use the trope as is, but instead take it a step further and kind of parallel Tom's isolation while out at speed traps with Sonic's loneliness. However, instead of talking to himself as Tom lords over donuts, throw in Pretzel Lady and Dr. Robotnik named Eggman because you're third for the rule of three. All of Sonic's nicknames, for lack of knowing the people's names, are associated with food. You can then infer that Sonic perceived Robotnik's robots as resembling eggs. Now there's one last thing, Tommy, that he puts in here that I thought you would get a kick out of. P.S. A close friend of mine had the same Asian horror films class around the same time, if not the same time you did. He speaks of the professor as you have on the channel. It tickles me when you bring it up. Do you know which professor I'm referring to?
Of course I am.
Yeah,
of course you do. I know.
So Tommy also had this professor, but a different class.
I did, yeah.
We won't say her name, but she was legendary for telling kids how fucking stupid they are in the middle of class.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, smart. One of the smartest ladies ladies I've ever met, but she would had no fear of saying, "Don't use that word, you fucking twat," you know, something like that in class.
That's amazing.
All right, guys, if you want to send us an email, hit us up at movies@wisecrack.co or leave us a voicemail at 213-534-8807. Sounds like this is a big Reddit discussion movie. I never really go on Reddit before preparing for these podcasts because I want it to be semi-original. Yeah. So if there's a lot of stuff that is on there in the interwebs that we did not bring up, give us a call, send us an email. Once again, that's 213-534-8807 or movies@wisecrack.co. We're going to be back in 2 weeks. Helen, who also hosts on the channel, really wants to talk about the movie Contagion since there's all this stuff going on in the news.
I can't imagine why.
And then...
That's not going to do anything to make me feel better at all. If I have to hear you guys talk about Contagion.
It has a happy ending. I mean, people die, but...
I actually have not seen it.
Oh, spoiler.
Yeah, yeah. And then at some point, we're doing Melancholia.
Yeah.
That does not.
It's the opposite. All right. I want to thank Tommy and Austin for joining me, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with Contagion.
Sweet.
As always, see you guys later. Peace.
Later.